Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 26, recorded on May 18th, 2018. We were off for a week. I had a bunch of conferences and stuff, so I hope you didn't miss us too much. But we've got a lot of fun news. And because, you know, I'm diving back 2 weeks ago, I figured I might dive back even farther for our first story. But before we get to that, I have a co-pilot here with me, Steve Brokaw, second time in the co-pilot seat. How you doing, man?
Great. No, I appreciate you having me on, and it's I'm looking forward to the conversation. We got some good topics to talk about today.
Yeah, you know, it's fun when I'm off for 2 weeks, the good stuff ends up coming to the top. And I chose some of these stories specifically because I figured you would have some valuable input on them. What's been keeping you busy the last little while?
Well, I've still been working almost exclusively on all my fashion and portrait work in studios. So I've been very busy doing shoots there. And then, as you know, I do a lot of film work. So whenever I'm not in the studio, I've been shooting a lot of film. I've been doing some experimental films, creating some unusual color films myself. And
wait, hold on a second. Yeah. you're creating your own film emulsions.
Yeah. What I've been doing is that I've been taking some stock color film and I've put it into a dark tube, the length of a roll. And then I've cut holes in it and pre-exposed it to different color lights and different times. And so it kind of gives a unusual looking cast. And then I'm doing this in a dark room and I just roll it back into the can and then go out and shoot it. So every roll has like light leaks in it, but they're different colored light leaks. And you use that with different types of film cameras and you don't know what you're going to get. Sometimes it looks completely stupid. Other times it looks really cool. So I'm playing around with that right now.
I mean, the harder you work, the luckier you are with that kind of stuff. I know that there is one company that does pre-exposed film. I forget the name of them off the top of my head, but the way you're doing it makes that entire process your art from beginning to end. Yeah. And I think that becomes really valuable.
It's just for fun. I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, like in some of the topics we're going to talk about today, you know, you can't take photography too seriously. You have to have fun with it as well. And, you know, my photography in the studio is pretty, you know, serious, technical, trying to get every image to look really the way the client wants it. Whereas on the street side and on the film side, it's all just for fun. So yeah, I've been playing around with creating different types of looks and hopefully I'll get something that looks reasonable and I can use it consistently.
And I see with your Twitter posts and everything else that you're constantly, you know, going out with an old film camera and just shooting a roll or whatever it is and having some fun with it. In terms of those old cameras, I mean, they're all fully functional and can create a good image. But I don't know if you have one, but what is your favorite film camera to use?
Right now, my favorite film camera is an old Russian camera. It's a Fed 4. I had this probably about 2 months now, and I've put an Instar lens on it, and it's got a real quirky feel to it, and it's a rangefinder, and it's just completely manual, and it's just a lot of fun to shoot. But what I find is then I'll find something else, and then I have another camera that's my best camera. You know, I have an old Leica CL that I purchased a couple of months ago that was my favorite camera for a while. I am by no means, you know, somebody that says, you know, you have to have this camera and you have to stick with it. I just, whatever I have right now.
When people have gifted me cameras, you know, film cameras, you know, I love just using it even once, just for the experience. I might not run another roll of film through it. In fact, for one, it was a 110 camera from Pentax. In fact, I typically keep it here on my desk just because it's a really cute, tiny little SLR. Well, getting 110 film was nearly impossible. I mean, I was able to find a couple of cartridges of expired film, and I don't even know if I've developed it, but I did shoot a roll through it just to say, hey, this thing still works. And
The thing that's nice is that you can buy 110 film again. Lamography sells an Earl
Grey. Oh, do they? Okay, I haven't looked in a while, maybe I'll have to take this through another go.
Well, just like on the right there, you have your Instamatic. There's a company that's in Italy that makes little adapters, or if you have any skills in 3D printing, you can make adapters for that. And so I actually have a couple of Instamatics that you load 35 millimeter film into a cartridge. That's been custom made, and you shoot those things. It's so fun.
Well, and again, it all boils back to the idea that if photography is all seriousness, then you lose your passion.
Exactly.
For it.
I agree.
And so we have fun in so many different ways. And my main camera is a 1DX Mark II. It's mm-hmm. a big, beastly camera. Right. If I'm going on vacation, it's not fun to take that with me. Mm-hmm. You know, not only am I going to worry if somebody steals it and that affects my livelihood, but, you know, I'd probably take a different camera, something right. that is more enjoyable to use, or just use my cell phone for that matter.
No, I agree, because I have, Nikon kit, and I have, the big Nikon equipment for the studio work. I use an old Sony A6000 for my play around camera, just shooting around. But whenever I'm just having fun, it's film. And, whatever camera I have, that's what I use.
Awesome. Well, let's get into the first story here. This one is actually a story from 2016, mm-hmm. But I got linked to it from one that was kind of a joking article on Petapixel.
Right.
And this was, the title of it was How to Edit Photos Like Steve McCurry, subtitled The Art of Removing Distractions. And this is actually a really valuable lesson, mm-hmm. Not for photojournalism purposes, because you should never do that as a photojournalist, but I do this a lot with my work. If there's anything within the frame of a photograph that doesn't support the narrative or the subject, try to either remove it in camera by changing the angle, the focal length, whatever you have at your right. disposal, or get rid of it in post-processing mm-hmm. in order to simplify the image. And I think engineers do much the same thing. If you're trying to build any mechanical device, you have to make it as simple as possible for right. it to work reliably. And any additional complexity is a point of failure.
Agreed.
And so photography ends up being that same sort of subtractive artwork.
Right.
It's actually a pretty interesting article. As a photojournalist, again, it's kind of an absolute no-no to do this sort of stuff. But we looked back in a linked article, I think it was in the comments on that one, and The Eyes of the Afghan Girl, a critical take on the, quote, Steve McCurry scandal, because back in 2016, he was accused of editing people out of some of his photojournalistic work, doing modifications to the work that is sort of against the ethics
right.
that photojournalism is sort of built around. So, Steve, I want you to take it from here. What do you think, first of all, about the article about removing distractions? And then when you see that apply to even the smallest elements of the Afghan Girl photograph, what's your opinion?
I think you have to differentiate between photojournalism, or what I'll call, real life situations, whether it's street photography, where you want to capture a scene exactly the way it exists. Especially when you have photojournalism, I don't think it's appropriate to remove anything. That's where, you have to zoom with your feet. You have to go to the right angle. You need to get the image the way it actually looks. And that even means don't set it up. Don't plan it. Ask somebody, hey, move out of the way. It has to be captured the way it is. However, I think that's a very specific genre. I think it's very specific in how you do it. In pretty much anything else, there's going to be the need to possibly take things out. If, let's say, today a contemporary Instagram influencer, those images are completely edited. I mean, they're staged, they're manipulated, items are removed. And that's what a lot of people see today. Whether it's a fashion shoot like what I do, a portrait shoot, you're taking items out. You're trying to improve it. You're not necessarily changing it. You're just trying to improve it.
You want people to see an image of themselves that is true to them, right?
Exactly.
True to what they imagine themselves to be. And so if they had, a couple of pimples that week,
right.
then yeah, that's not true to them in the permanent sense. And so you would, fix that either with makeup or in post-processing
right.
in order to change that. It's an entirely different thing, even though, we're talking about a portrait of a person.
Right. But I do think that if you have something where you're representing it, this is the way it looks, you have to keep it the way it looks. But if you look at all the tools we have today, Photoshop, Lightroom, Capture One, all the major tools, one of the big selling points is the fact that, look how easy it is to remove distractions. Look how easy it is to clean an image up, change the light, change the tone, change the color grading. So almost everybody's built in with the fact that you can manipulate an image. And honestly, I have no major issues with that as long as you don't sell it as, hey, this is the way the picture actually looks right now. That's where I think somebody like McCurry got so much grief is simply because he represented it, is that this is the way it really looks. And yet even a simple thing like the Afghan girl where it's just a subtle modification, it's still...
And we should mention what that modification is. Right. In the original National Geographic publication, there is a speck of dirt or a specular highlight or something right. in the corner of her eye, just a little white dot. Mm-hmm. And in the original National Geographic cover, that's mm-hmm. not there.
Right.
But in subsequent scans of that original negative, or I think it was shot on Kodachrome possibly, mm-hmm. but doesn't matter. It's there. And
right.
so when you compare it to the original image from National Geographic, now Steve McCurry wouldn't have done this edit. It would have been an editor at National Geographic or some executive that right. made a call to make that change. So I don't think he's directly responsible in that case.
Correct.
But he is selling a poster of the Afghan girl, or at least he was at the time this mm-hmm. article was published, that has that speck in the eye still there. And right. in subsequent National Geographic publications, it has returned, actually.
Right.
And in a, I think it was a retrospective article that was published for the special members edition, 100 Best Pictures, they put the Afghan girl back right. on the cover. And this was a really important comparison because this one appears much less edited than either of the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I noticed very specifically about this is behind her left cheek, camera right, there is some faded, dull, or damaged fabric that is sort of a gray color in tone mm-hmm. That on the National Geographic cover has been made a bit smoother. But on the Steve McCurry version, it's almost entirely gone. Like
right.
he has gone back and repaired that damaged fabric. Now, to me, that's a bigger issue than the speck in the eye, even
right.
though you shouldn't do either of them, because maybe the clothing is newer. Maybe she is wealthier or, you know, it might adjust what people think of her level of poverty.
Right.
And that is an important change that I don't think should be made.
Yeah. You know, bottom line is I think you have to have a knowledge of what the intent is. If it's photojournalism, you leave it alone. You don't do anything to
it. We can't make a judgment call here. We can't say, okay, well, is this on the side of proper ethics versus
right.
you know this kind of an edit, which would not be?
Right.
You just have to blanket say, you can't edit it.
Right.
But even then, I mean, you've got to crop it for the cover, right? You've got to do something that will adjust the edges of the frame for the format for which
right.
it's going to be produced in.
Right. And I think that's considered part of the normal photojournalism ethics. You can crop. But if you're going in and saying that, you know what, this girl has a certain image, this scene has a certain look, and you go in and you take out something distracting or you significantly add something or you change it so it's not the way it really is, I don't think that's correct. However, that's photojournalism. Everything else today, so give you an example. Let's say you're doing fashion work or you're doing portrait work or you're shooting your best friend, whatever. And let's say they have a few pimples and those are temporary. You can ethically, you can take those out, but let's say they've got a little bit extra pounds and you want to give them a digital diet. That's not cool because if somebody looks at them later and says, well, that picture doesn't look like you because, or you've smoothed out their skin or you've changed the color of their eyes. That's not cool. But
what if they specifically request you to do that?
That's different. You know, if you're getting paid to change somebody, that's different because that's the intent.
Right.
But if somebody hires me and they want to have a fashion shoot done or they want to have a portraiture done, ethically, what I'm allowed to do is I can color grade it. I can take out temporary things. But if you have a scar on your face and it's permanent, that's not going to go. It's just, what is your intent? If you have a vacation picture and you're going to put it up on Instagram because you're an influencer and there's some guy sitting in the background you need to take him out, you take him out. So it's, what's the intent? And the thing that's really interesting today is I think because the tools are so easy to do these things
mm-hmm.
that as you get newer people that come into the genres, that come into the industry, it's more acceptable to do these type of changes. Whereas in the past, I think it was harder to do. And so when somebody did it, it might be a little bit more like, oh, you know, that's not acceptable. So I really think that today it's more acceptable that you alter an image. And the same thing's happening with digital. I mean, with audio, the same thing's happening with pretty much anything you can do. The tools are so powerful, you can change them.
Oh, exactly. And I've seen some very powerful video tools that if you have to make a jump cut in a video, just like a talking head, somebody, it will match up the two sides of the video to completely hide the cut.
Right.
And I mean, that's all done automatically. Artificial intelligence is coming up quite a ways within that. And it really makes me question, like, what is real? I mean, reality is subjective, but if I go back to the Hallmark images of National Geographic and I can't trust them 100%,
correct,
and things are so easy to modify today, then photojournalism, is it dead in the truest, most authentic sense?
I don't think it is. I think that it's just, it's not as enforced, mainly because a lot of, you know, publications, they don't use professional photographers like you used to. I mean, there's a lot of stories been out in the last couple of years about U.S. newspaper laying off the photographic staff and using stringers that are just people like you and me that have their cell phone cameras. So I think the ethics may not be as important as they used to be, or at least they're not followed as much. But I think one of the other issues that you need to think about too is we're talking about taking items out. And the ethics of taking things out or the power of taking things out. What about putting things in that aren't there? I mean, if you say, well, it's okay to take things out, you're manipulating an image, then I guess you could say, well, it's okay to put something in.
Right. Well, and I think North Korea had done some military promotional photos. Mm-hmm. And I think it was that they were doing a beach storming exercise or something. And they photoshopped in extra ships and extra troops. And I think there was another one where they added extra missiles into another photograph. And so, yeah, you know, you add things in to bolster, you know, whatever it is you're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And now it's storytelling.
Right.
It's and that story can be completely fiction.
As a matter of fact, I think that was one of the things that was used in the Steve McCurry article about visual storytelling, that it really wasn't photojournalism. It was, you know, you're telling a story. And because of that, you may want to alter the facts just a little bit to get your John, you know, to get your story out there. Honestly, for me, it takes too much work. So I try to minimize it. You know, I spend too much time in Lightroom and Photoshop. I don't want to spend time taking out something. And, you know, that's why in street photography, when I do that, I don't change anything. You know, if I see something that's distracting, I might, you know, change the contrast a little bit, or I might crop it a certain way, but, you know, I don't change anything. And I don't want to spend time editing. I want to spend time taking the image.
I'm envious of you because I spend sometimes 5 to 10 hours working on an image and post-processing. And it's required in order to actually return a little bit to reality to increase the depth in certain macro photographs and things like that.
Yeah, but again, that's different. That's the intent. And that's,
exactly.
You know, if you didn't do that, I would look at your image and say, oh, this is nothing. You know, but I think the fact is because you're creating these macro images that have a certain beauty to them, part of that is that you're doing the manipulation to stack the layers, and people know that.
Well, exactly. And if I see a flower inside of a water droplet, I didn't Photoshop it there, right? And I'm making it more realistic by increasing the depth just to increase the natural beauty and the natural physics of things. And that is my intent, because the magic does not come from me tinkering and post-processing. It already has to be there in camera as the raw footage would present. So interesting times as photographers. Neither of us are photojournalists, so we can opine all we want on photojournalism. But we are armchair quarterbacks at that point.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the next story, which, you know what? I'm surprised I didn't think of this sooner. And this has to do with noise reduction in cameras and how we can improve upon that. You know, there's a lot of algorithms out there. I have found the one from Adobe in Lightroom and Camera Raw actually fails in some of my images. Mm-hmm. We're talking about some of my extreme macro work that has like a magenta cast, like a really strong fluorescing magenta kind of color. Mm-hmm. and I don't even know why, but when I increase the noise reduction slider to reduce the noise, the noise actually increases in some areas. And I just, the algorithm is just not smart enough in every possible way. I've been using the On1 Photo RAW processor recently more and more, and they've handled it a bit better. DxO has their prime noise reduction, and I don't really want to go there for an entire workflow with that product. But there's a lot of different software out there that does noise reduction. So why don't you apply artificial intelligence to this? I mean, NVIDIA has been doing this a lot with, repairing, images or reconstructing faces that don't exist. And that technology has come a long way. So simply removing noise from an existing photograph should be simple by comparison. And so it's taking low light photography really to another level. I'm sure you read this article, Steve. What do you think about the progress being made here?
I think it's amazing. I think I've just seen over the last 10, 15 years about the ability to take lower light images and getting higher quality pictures. And, I looked at the article and looked at some of the photos that they put in there, and it's like, oh, that's really amazing. Now, my question is that what would be the application for something like that? I mean, you're talking about some ISO ranges that are just enormous. So I can see, maybe military official use, like using it in drones, things like that. But I'm not necessarily personally going to be shooting inside of a closet at night. So I don't particularly need it, but I think it's nice because there would be situations, let's say street photography, or you're taking a photograph in a restaurant or something like that, where you need a little bit better quality. And I think it's a great idea. It'll be interesting to see how the large camera companies, if they put this in their cameras, or how it's applied, whether like an Adobe buys that technology and applies it to the Lightroom or Photoshop. It'll be interesting to see how it's played out, but I think it's a really good idea.
There's an interesting catch here that at first I didn't even pick up on. But for all of their example photographs that they work on with this artificial intelligence, they're not a properly exposed image. In one of the examples here, they've got one that is slightly underexposed but readable at ISO 409,600. Let's just call that 400,000. And it looks really noisy, as that image would. But the image that they work on from artificial intelligence is, to our eyes, looking at it, is just a black blob. Like there's no detail whatsoever. And it shot at ISO 8000. And they use that one processed through the AI system to bring up detail from blackness rather than process the noise out of a higher ISO image. And every one of the example images is done this way. And I'm not sure if there's a specific reason for that, but I'm thinking about astrophotography as a possible use case for this. Because if you want to do deep space imaging, I know a lot of people will take very short exposures that are near black and stack them together to increase the brightness. Right. But what if the artificial intelligence can enhance that process? And in doing so, quite significantly get you good results from a single frame, or maybe you only need 10 images instead of 100 or 1,000 in order to take a photograph of a nebula or a galaxy, something in deep space. So there are immediate use cases for that. And whether you're an amateur astronomer trying to find a way to explore the night sky, or if some of this tech could be envisioned in the next generation of hardware for the next telescopes, either terrestrial or in space, knowing full well how this technology can interpret very, very dark images, you might design the cameras to provide that that as an input coming right out of the equipment so that we can work with that in an entirely different way. So it's fun. It's interesting. Artificial intelligence is getting really scary. I mean, it's got the ability to improve our work and enhance our creative efforts. But going back to the first story, it can so easily falsify things and make what is true appear untrue, or vice versa. And yeah, it's looking great in terms of cleaning up noise, although it is doing that based on some intelligence, and that requires decision making, right? It's not a blanket similar algorithm across every part of the image that can be calculated. So then the computers have a judgment call in certain areas, and that in some ways might damage the authenticity of the results, especially if you're trying to directly apply it to scientific research.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of the similar vibe as the first article about changing an image. You could probably argue that artificial intelligence, you know, is it being used to change the image? You know, you're having some input from an individual saying, okay, do this, do that. So you're changing the image. However, from what I've understood and what I've read about this article and this technology is that you're really not adding anything or taking anything away. It's almost like you're taking what's there and you're making it available to be seen. You're improving it.
Right.
Which I don't have as much problem with. And I looked at some of those images because I do a lot of street photography and do a lot at night. And I can't tell you the number of times I've come back in really excited about images, looked at the images, and it's like, oh, nothing came out. You know, it's all black. And I think if I had a camera or technology, whether it was in a software program or in the camera itself, that could improve that image and bring it out so that it actually looks as if how I saw it, that would be great. So I actually thought this was a pretty interesting idea, but I don't want to get into the idea of AI because that's a whole scary subject, you know,
How some of the social media use it. If they could do this, I don't know how much processing power it requires, but if they could build that into the camera as a noise processor right in the camera itself and present that with some level of authenticity as an output product, then I'm very okay with it.
Yeah, definitely. I have a feeling that something like this will become a standalone program that you can run images through and it'll use its AI technology to improve the image. Or it'll become something that Adobe buys or some other program buys and makes it part of their program.
We will be using this in our workflow in the very near future is what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, look, at the end of the day, I have images that I take where the light didn't fire, the light didn't properly recycle. And it may be a great image, but I can't use it because it's too dark. In the current technology that I have in my programs, I can add exposure, I can increase the highlights, I can increase the white point, the black point. But bottom line is I can't recover that image so that it looks good. But if you have a technology like this that can, you know, that it's there, you just, you know, the light wasn't appropriate for the image and improve it, that I could see that could even be in my genre.
We live in a world of technology and innovation.
Yes.
To our benefit in some cases, and in some ways, it's almost pointless. Which brings us to the next story, which is Yung Nuo, who's a Chinese manufacturer that their products are cheaper than I could imagine for the quality that they offer. Like, I use their flashes quite often.
It's a really good company.
And they have come out with the Yung Nuo YN43. Which is a four-thirds, I guess that's where the 4.3 comes from, smartphone clip-on camera. Okay, color me intrigued. Until it uses the Canon EF mount. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, this device clips onto the phone. So the phone is the software engine and the screen and for the most part, the control. There might be a button or two on the camera body itself, but it's mostly just this cube thing that has a lens mount on it. And so you are supposed to, with this product, clip your phone on the back of it and use this as if it were a regular camera. Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody, Steve, that would purchase such a device?
There was a couple products that came out a few years ago similar to this, and I saw this article, and my first question was why? I cannot think of anybody in my circle that would use something like this, because if you're just going to use your smartphone. I mean, they take great pictures.
And if you're going to go for a Micro Four Thirds sensor, then why are you going to put a big honking piece of glass in front of it? If you're going to be carrying around an EF lens, like something that is generally flexible, like a 24-105 or something of that nature, that is a big lens. If you're going to attach that to a proper camera, or even adapt that to the Canon EOS M system or something, if that's what you want to do for a purpose-built device, nobody, I think, would be carrying around this monstrosity and say, oh, let me just clip my phone into it. I know that there are a lot of cell phone lenses that just work with your existing cameras, and they're oftentimes little unobtrusive clip-on things. This is massive. You need to carry that in its own camera bag or in a large purse or something, which defeats the entire purpose of cell phone photography.
I was thinking about this, and I was, you know, really thinking hard, trying to be as nice as I could to the product designer, and I'm thinking, what would be situations that I would use something like this? And I couldn't think of a one. You know, almost all cameras today, Micro Four Thirds, no matter who makes them, the small point and shoots, they all can connect to your phone. You know,
they always have Wi-Fi or Bluetooth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, if you're going to have that type of lens, you might as well have a reasonable camera to go along with it, because you're going to have a bag. You just can't carry that in your pocket. So I was thinking, no, there's absolutely no need. And the other problem that I have with something like this is the connectivity to the actual camera body part itself, because you're still connecting. And I think one of the biggest challenges that I've had a lot of times with cameras is that the Wi-Fi connection gets messed up. And I'm sure that's the same problem here.
If that's the primary way of communicating to the camera and something happens, then you no longer have a camera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I looked at that and I thought, okay, it's great. Somebody's designing something. You know, I'm sure that there might be a proof of concept they're trying to go for. But bottom line is, I couldn't see it.
What if the cost is so low that this camera costs $40 or $50?
Doesn't matter. You still have to get a lens.
Right. But you can get EF lenses for pennies or adapt a lens to that. And we're talking in manual focus. And what I'm imagining here is, could I do like a bullet time matrix style thing using some of these cameras? Because if they are that cheap, mm-hmm. and I can get some old Russian lens for a couple of dollars, right. on eBay that I can adapt to this, put them all in a ring and shoot, right. video of all of that. Somehow maybe the software can be adapted to control multiple cameras at once, or maybe I have to dig through my closet and pull out all of my old cell phones or find some other way to control them. That is the only use case that I could possibly have, is if the cost is so low and I have a huge number of cameras required to document something happening, then maybe. And so they'll sell that to like a dozen people for that project around the world, and that's it.
Yeah, that's a specialized use. And I think the thing is, too, is that you're a professional photographer that knows a lot about photography, as I do, too. And so we can understand these things. But if you're going to the typical type of person that goes to a Costco or an equivalent type of store and spends $400 for a really nice DSLR that they can throw in their backpack, you're not going to buy something like this, because then you've got to figure out, okay, I need a lens. Where do I get a lens? Oh, you can get an adapter. Where do I get an adapter? No, I just don't see this as being a commercially viable product. I think it's more of a proof of concept, and I applaud them for that. But personally, I wouldn't buy it.
Neither would I. Or maybe, again, if it is so cheap, just to have as a little anachronism sitting on my shelf. Because I like some of these weird, unusual cameras. I almost bought, and it's the name is escaping me now, but it was a reinvention of a brand that used film canisters to change a digital camera setting. It was a Kickstarter campaign recently. We talked about it on an earlier episode.
The Yashica,
yes.
Yeah.
And so whoever bought the rights to the Yashica brand are mm-hmm. digging it a deeper grave. But I was looking at that and just thinking, well, what a quirky concept,
right.
that in 10 years will be completely forgotten, mm-hmm. As whatever hipster vibe that it had. Just like going back and taking, you know, digging out an old Sony Mavica that used floppy mm-hmm. disks or something,
right.
you know, that might have been innovative, but really never caught on because, you know, the world was not moving in that direction.
Yeah. And bottom line is that I can't talk. I mean, I'm shooting old film cameras that are older than me, and just things that I pick up and I'm making my own emulsions and things like that. So
I got to ask though, what is your oldest film camera?
I've got a camera that is a box camera that was it's like at the beginning of film. I mean, it still surprisingly works. I don't even know what it is. It's on my shelf back here. But the thing is enormous, and it's probably over 100 years old.
Yeah, my oldest is, from what I can gather, a circa 1906 Century Studio mm-hmm. 11 by 14 camera made of cast iron and hardwood that sits in the entrance to my studio. So hard to use that one. I've got a 1926 Rolitoscope here on my desk that I have used.
Well, I've got every film camera I got. The first thing I do is I check it to see if it works. If it works, I've shot them. So I actually use them.
That's awesome. Talking about old cameras, uh-huh. there are old cameras in the digital world as well.
Yes.
You know, and I remember my dad with a bonus from work at one point bought one of the earliest Kodak point and shoot cameras. It was around a megapixel, maybe even a little bit less than that. I still have the camera, and it took 4 megabyte compact flashcards, which, funny enough, still work in my camera. I mean, I could plug that in and I have to set it to like a low resolution JPEG to record anything to it. But it's amazing how that's adapted. Anyhow, my very first camera, well before I was a photographer, I was a very nerdy, geeky child that loved to play video games. And I found a Game Boy camera in a pawn shop and bought it for like 10 bucks. And with my bike driving down or riding down the road to a beaver pond, I remember trying to get close enough to a beaver to take a picture of it on this camera. That is not a possibility. It turned out to be like 2 or 3 pixels across this. I think it's 144 by 144 pixel resolution camera, black and white, and 4 shades of gray. And so this was a wonderful toy for Nintendo to produce for their Game Boy system. And the original Game Boy that ran this had like a 1 kilohertz processor, or like it was just so painfully slow. Right. It's amazing that they could ever get a camera to operate on this thing. And I'm confused why people still want to use that camera today until I think it's fun. Right. It's useless beyond the novelty of saying, hey, look at this really weird camera. Like people take the whatever the Apple camera is, they made 2 versions of way back in the 90s and people still use because it's an Apple made camera. But have you ever thought of taking one of those digital antiques and doing anything like shooting an F1 race with it?
I have not. You know, I use old film cameras, but I've got a stack of digital cameras that are sitting in my closet that I've never touched. Unless it was just for something like a, you know, like this article about a Game Boy where they've taken it out and shot something. Again, that's just for fun. Somebody's probably done something, say, hey, why can't we do this? I mean, it'd probably be a good Instagram project where you can stick those images up on Instagram. But you know what? Applaud them, because bottom line is that somebody thought, hey, this is a fun idea. Let's try this out.
Yeah, well, they attached an $8 cell phone clip-on telephoto lens to the Game Boy camera. Even if it's the worst optics imaginable, it doesn't matter in this particular instance. And now you've got a telephoto lens on that Game Boy camera. It is a 0.016 megapixel camera. Even in 1998, they had much higher resolution cameras, but not for a toy, not for the original Game Boy. But I've experimented with this, and this was even before I knew photography would be fun for me. I had just started playing around in Photoshop. It was I came into Photoshop around version 5 or 6, and I had the Game Boy camera, and I wanted to move some of the photos from that to my computer. And Mad Catz, the accessory company that I think is now defunct, they made a cable that would allow you to capture data intended to go from the Game Boy camera to the Game Boy printer, because Nintendo wanted everybody's money. You could print out those photographs. And so it would intercept that information and give you a complete pristine digital version of that. I think it only worked in Windows 98, so you'd have to have a really old computer to get it to function these days. But I was able to transfer them to the computer pristinely and perfectly, and then do what with them in Photoshop? I mean, there's nothing that could really be done with these images. But I found a novel use. I was able to take some colored filters, which, as a child, where did I find them? It was just the little colored tabs that would go on different file separators in a file cabinet. Those were colored enough and big enough to fit over the lens of the Game Boy camera. And I would slide it in front really quickly before the exposure changed and took a picture with red, green, and blue, and transferred all of those images to the computer and loaded them up in Photoshop as color channels, which not only gave me a color image, but it was more than just 4 colors, because you had the adaption of adding those up. So it was a much more detailed colored version of the Game Boy camera. And to my knowledge, I think I'm the only one that has shot color photos with the Game Boy camera. So that's my claim to fame. And I'm going to put one of those in the show notes for this episode so that everybody can go and take a look at that. Again, it's pointless, 100%, but it's also a little fun.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think if you do photography professionally, or you just do it because you want to make money, it becomes a job. But if you have fun with it, you know, you Go out and play with new tools, new cameras, you try new things, new techniques. That's what keeps it fun. And I have no problems at all with somebody bringing out something like that and playing around with it. I mean, it's just, it's novel and it's great. I love it.
Perfect. And, you know, in my line of work, and I'm sure you're much the same, Steve, we're multifaceted. I mean, I take pictures, I sell pictures, I work with documentary film companies, I teach people, I do presentations. One of the things that I do on a regular basis is print. And I do a number of galleries and art shows and things like that a year. One big art show that I typically do in August, I'm already starting to plan what I'm going to be printing for that particular show. If you don't own your own printer, especially when you want to make something big, it's really not feasible to do an entire gallery exhibition and pay somebody else to produce it, because that might cost you, you know, $2,000, $3,000 in just the printing, especially if you're printing larger stuff like, you know, 30 by 20, 36 by 24 size images. And so my pick of the week, we're getting into that that section now. My pick of the week is the Canon Image Prograph Pro 2000. This is a 24-inch wide printer. So it's got a 2-foot wide carriage, and you could print easily 36 by 24, but it's a roll. So you could print, you know, 60 by 24 if you wanted to print a big panorama or a tall vertical. A lot of people don't realize, they think that this is a massive machine. It's, you know, it's like half my height and weighs more than I do. You would think that these things have a ridiculous price tag associated with them. It's $2,500.
Right.
And so that will get you the printer and an initial set of ink. Paper in rolls per square inch is not as expensive as you might imagine, and you can even print on canvas. I've spent more on a lens that does improve my photography, but I think some photographers out there, and I'm not talking about everybody, should do a little bit of investment into a printer. I owned the earlier version of this, the IPF 6300, before they changed the naming scheme. And I have behind me the 8400, which is a 44-inch printer from Canon that uses almost the exact same equipment inside. I can print, the biggest I've done is like a 40 by 80 canvas and a 66 by 44 version of my snowflake poster print that's in my studio. And it's just gorgeous. That printer cost me $7,000. But the 60-inch version is $20,000. I mean, it just goes exponentially higher. This is an investment. And as a pick, I think a lot of people should look at a larger format printer, not just your standard, it would be 13 by 19, is the size lower than this on sheets, but spend a few $1,000s and you will spend a few $100s making mistakes and learning the printing world and calibration and cleaning up the images and making sure that the print looks like it does on the screen. As soon as you do that and you've kind of trained yourself to do that, every print that you make is going to be something that you're really, really happy with. And you get to experiment with different types of papers, like Inkpress makes a metallic satin paper that I love for my snowflake work and my infrared work, and my clients are liking it as well. No other print house around me uses that kind of paper. So it gives you a lot more creative artistic flexibility. Steve, just like when you were pre-exposing your film to different colors, that's art. Printing is an art form as well. And embrace that. Make sure that it's yours all the way through the entire pipeline.
Oh, I agree. And I saw the your pick of the week, and I looked at the price, and I thought, oh, that's wrong. You know, they've made a mistake on that because
they forgot a zero.
Yeah, very, very good price. And I agree. I think there's an initial investment, just like buying a camera. You have that investment. There's a learning curve because you're going to spend a ton of time learning about color profile, how to print correctly. But once you get that done, having a high quality printer like that is really good if you're going to actually print your pictures out. And for somebody like myself, because I have a studio in my hometown, as part of our studio, there's a gallery. And we have regular exhibits in our gallery. And one of the biggest criticisms we get when we go out and ask people to present or to show is that it costs them a fortune to get the prints done. And so, you know, some people get low-end prints and it looks low-end, or they'll try to print it themselves and, you know, they're putting it at just a smaller 8x10 size. And having something like this, if we could do something like this in the gallery where we could actually print out for them, give them that the option, it would be very, very good. So I think it's something like this. It's maybe somebody who just takes pictures of their dog or their cat. Yeah, you don't need a nice printer like that, but a professional photographer or an agency or a gallery, something like this would be a great investment. And again, it's an investment.
I can tell you a couple of times where I was doing Kempenfest, which is the big art show here in my city in the summertime, and I made a 30 by 40 print of one of my water droplet images.
Right.
Thinking, wouldn't that be nice if it sell? Well, it sold immediately before the show even opened when I was setting up and putting things on the wall. So I'm thinking, okay, well, this is going into a weekend here. Let me rush home, print another one. And so while I was continuing to set up, another person came by and wanted to buy that exact same print that the first person hadn't just taken yet because they walked away. They wanted to take it to their car when they were finished with the show. So now I've sold two of them and I only have one. So I rush home and I make two more because one for the new client that I promised that it would be there tomorrow, and then another one to put back up on the wall. And so the second day of the art show, I'm there stretching them at the show around, because these are done on canvas. I'm stretching them around the stretcher bars. The first person is there waiting for theirs, and another person is looking at a smaller version of that that I had made as a 20 by 28. And they said, that's great. And they're talking to their wife, thinking, well, where can we put that in the house? And they're thinking, and I'm overhearing them. They're saying, well, it would be great here, but it's not big enough. And
not
I said,
enough.
I'm sorry that you're saying it's not big enough. And I'm actively stretching it, but it's face down. They don't see it. And I lift it up. Is this what you want? And I sold it to them again. And then I went home and printed another one. As exhausting as it is to do these art shows, I had the ability to go and create new artwork on the fly for something that I knew was selling really well. If you do not have the printer in your own hands, I would have lost a few thousand dollars in sales from that art show. And that pays for the printer right there.
Absolutely. No, again, I think it's for the person who needs to have prints, it's a looks like a great investment. Again, I was shocked at the price. I thought it was going to be, you know, twice as much at minimum. And honestly, if I had a nice printer like that, I would print a lot more of my work because I send everything
out. I'm just looking
out
at the new prices here, and I'm envious of the U.S. prices because the 44-inch newer version of the printer is now only $4,000. And if you want to go for a 60-inch printer, which you'll probably never use it much at that size. But if you do one or two prints that require like a 60 by 90, it'll pay for the price difference really when you go up to the $10,000 price, which is much cheaper than they used to be. When I had the 44-inch model brought into my studio here, it took three technicians to drag it in and assemble it. And that was included in the price.
Right. Yeah, it's a good pick. I'm envious. I'd love to have something like that.
All right. Well, I'm curious what your pick is. You haven't told me beforehand. So what have you got up your sleeve?
I'm actually going to go on the other side of the price range. You know, as you know, I do a lot of film work, and so I have a lot of lenses. And so what I've found is that in many cases, I have to have an adapter for the lens to the body. And what's also good is that a lot of people who have micro four thirds, a lot of the manual older lenses are really good for video because they're silent. And so I've been buying adapters for the last couple of years. Well, I found this company just recently. It's based in China, in Shenzhen, a company called KNF Concepts. And I'll send you the link, but it's kentfaith.com. And they make a series of custom-made adapters. And I have one here that I'm showing you that's for a Leica camera. So it's a thread mount Leica to a regular mount Leica. And this was only like $20. And, you know, a lot of times people get worried because this is actually produced and shipped from China. I ordered this and got it within a week. And it was only $20 US. They come in really nice packages. It's really well done. It's very professional. The website has a lot of other things. It's a little bit like, you know, Jack of all trades where they sell, you know, adapters, but they also sell flashes and tripods and things like that. But it's an option, I think, that if you want to get an adapter that's really well made. I've used this company now twice for different types of lens to body adapters, and I really like them. So for, you know, from a price standpoint, from a quality standpoint and also from a speed of delivery standpoint, I really would recommend this company.
And we should state that these adapters, and I own one too, by the way, are typically manual only. They don't have automatic control of the lens that you're adapting to the camera. So they work really well with older lenses.
Right.
I recently used one of their adapters, the Micro Four Thirds to EOS, because I have a couple of manual EF lenses, including my Trioplan 100, which has a really nice soap bubble bokeh effect. And I wanted to try that with the Panasonic cameras that I've been testing. And it worked great. It worked perfectly because it's a manual lens. But for a magazine article recently, I adapted the Panasonic GX9 to an old Canon Bellows system from an FD to EOS and then EOS to Micro Four Thirds, just because those are the adapters that I had. And I used the 20 millimeter f3.5 Canon macro photo lens from 1976, I believe. And on the Bellows system, it can get up to 10:1 magnification.
Right.
Now, on a smaller sensor, no matter what aperture you choose, you're going to have diffraction that's going to soften things. And it is an older lens too. But I ended up with a full frame image of a pollen stamen that is in a magazine article now.
Wow.
That will be published in the next issue of Outdoor Photography Canada magazine using a really old macro lens that I was after the magnification in that case. And for macro, you don't need the latest and greatest innovations in autofocus and in image stabilization, especially if you're using flash as the light source. None of that stuff really matters. And so old lenses end up being incredibly useful. And if you get a good, solidly machined adapter, then take that and run with it.
Exactly. And what I like is that if you go and let's say you find an old camera and the camera doesn't work, let's say the curtain is broken or that just doesn't work, the lens will work. Almost always a lens. So, you know, get that camera in the Goodwill or the antique store or the thrift shop and just take the lens. And then you can use that lens on a Micro Four Thirds, especially if you do video, where you just want something that smoothly focuses. And these adapter rings I've found have worked really well. I've never had one that has let me down. So I really think this is a good option if you want to have a lens adapter.
Cool. And I love the experimentation that you have, that just enjoyment of putting different things together and see what works and what doesn't. And it's not even if it works, you're happy. If it doesn't, you're still happy. And I think that's important.
And at this price, if it doesn't work, you know, it's a $20 investment.
Right. And I've spent more than that on like all sorts of gadgets and clamps and arms and little tabletop tripods and things to put other ingredients together.
Yes.
So in terms of photographic equipment, it's almost free.
Right. Definitely. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're into the final throes of this episode. And thanks to everybody that has been listening thus far. You can find the show notes that has the stories of everything that we talked about and the picks of the week at photogeekweekly.com. But before we sign off, Steve, what is your passion moving forward? Do you have any interesting projects on the go? Any publications that you're working with? Any just purely passionate ideas that through the summer months, now that things are warming up, you'll be able to get into?
Yeah. Couple. One is obviously on my fashion portrait work. I'm continuing to work on that. I am in the process of expanding our studio to make it a much larger space. It's a lot of work on that. But what I'm also doing is that I'm starting up again my street photography city series. So what I've been doing started it last year. Is that like every month I pick a city that's within 8 hours drive from where I'm at. And I drive there and I spend a day or 2 days just taking shots of the city. And then hopefully within another year, I'll create a large gallery showing of different street shots in different cities. So
Brilliant. A lot of people don't realize how close things are. I mean, we're in North America and it's not nearly like it would be in Europe. But if I wanted to drive to New York, I can do that in a day.
Yeah, definitely. And so those are the two projects I'm doing right now. So I'm going to be up in Minneapolis in a couple weeks to start up that and was in New York earlier this year. So really enjoying that.
Fantastic. And for me, I've got a number of presentations coming up. If anybody is in the Greater Toronto area on the 21st and 22nd of June, I have got a workshop and presentation at the Toronto Botanical Gardens. The 27th of June is a free one at Panasonic's headquarters in Mississauga. I'm talking about ultraviolet and infrared photography. What else coming up? In July, I'm at the NECCC conference in Amherst, Massachusetts, and I have a full-day macro photography workshop in my own studios. If you're curious about where I'm going to be, just send me an email, and you can always check on my website at doncom.ca, where a lot of those workshops are posted. Princeton, New Jersey, and Ohio are also coming up later this year. So I'm going to be all over the place, and it's going to be fun. Hopefully, if you, if you'd like to meet up and learn a thing or two, or just have a great chat, find out where I'll be, and I look forward to those conversations.
Busy guy.
Well, hey, you know what? It's busier than I would have expected this year. A lot of stuff is just kind of appearing right in front of me, and I love it. And I'm so thrilled about some projects that are just on the cusp of being able to talk about publicly. I have seen the finished product, and I am just giddy with excitement to talk about that too. But that'll come within the next few months. Without further ado then, Steve, because we are just about again at that hour mark, which I like to end off on. We've talked your ear off. And so as photographers, we always like to talk shop, but just get out and shoot
right
at this point. Make your day a photographically creative one, and we'll see you next week.
Absolutely.